Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in, and here's what's happening today. Paige Browning was just telling you about cleanup near the Columbia River. Mosier, Oregon, just across the Washington border, an oil train derailed on Friday and caught fire. Well, the evacuation order for the city of Mosier was lifted today so people can go home. Reporter Amelia Templeton says now the focus is on questions about safety.
Loretta Sheeler was working outside her property along the railroad tracks last Friday afternoon, and she heard a train pull into town.
Usually when the trains come through town, sometimes there's a squealing of brakes, and it did catch my attention. I thought it was a little bit more of a knocking kind of squeal.
She didn't think much of the noise until she saw a black plume of smoke rise into the air. A few minutes later, the fire chief pulled up and told her and her neighbors to evacuate.
I had no idea that explosive crude oil, that 96 cart trains of crude oil were being pulled through the community. So to me, I'm in shock.
Sheeler loves Mosier. She just built an apartment and commercial space there with a sloping roof that's meant to look like the mountains across the river. She spent $500,000 on the building.
Which is my entire savings and retirement and daily wages and all the time I have is there. So
the oil train fire stopped just across the street from Sheeler's building. She wanted a bakery or a real estate office to move into the first floor, but it's been a struggle to attract businesses. Now, she thinks tenants will be afraid of being so close to the tracks.
So it's very stressful and very anxious and very concerned about what the future holds.
Mosier Fire Chief Jim Appleton says in the past, he's tried to be a mediator between the Union Pacific Railroad and his neighbors in town who oppose oil trains.
Assuring the community that, oh, you know, that they've got a great safety record and chances are minuscule. But it happened in our town.
Now Appleton says he's changed his mind.
I hope that this becomes a death knell for this mode of shipping this cargo. I think it's insane.
The disaster didn't take any lives and caused minimal property damage. In Appleton's view, that was a matter of luck.
If the same derailment had happened 24 hours earlier, there would have been 35 mile an hour gusts blowing the length of the train, so the fire could have very easily spread to some or all of the 96 cars behind.
Federal regulators say oil from the Bakken region is more flammable and more dangerous than other types of crude. Shipments through the Columbia River Gorge have increased in recent years. Emergency responders and communities along rail lines in the Northwest have struggled to prepare for a possible disaster. Departments have tried to stockpile critical equipment needed to fight oil fires, including a special type of fire suppression foam. But Appleton says that foam was of relatively little use for the first 10 hours after the fire started in Mosier. It couldn't be directly applied to the main rail car that was on fire.
The metal is just too hot, and the foam will land on the white-hot metal and just evaporate without any suppression effect.
To fight the fire, crews had to cool down the hot metal rail cars filled with explosive oil. Hour after hour, they sprayed the tankers with 1,500 gallons of water a minute, drawn from the Columbia River. At a press conference, Union Pacific spokeswoman Raquel Espinoza promised a full investigation and said the company would pay for the cost of the firefighting.
We apologize to the residents of Mosier, the state of Oregon, and the Pacific Northwest region.
Espinoza said a track inspection 4 days before the derailment found nothing out of the ordinary. Crude oil shipments make up less than 1% of the railroad's traffic, according to Espinoza. But that could change in the Northwest. Oil companies have proposed building the largest oil-by-rail terminal in the country. It would be at the Port of Vancouver, 70 miles down the Columbia River from Mosier. I'm Amelia Templeton, reporting.
Yes, we will find out whether that derailment has any effect on the proposed terminal at the Port of Vancouver, Washington. Meanwhile, the people of Mosier, Oregon, are still boiling their water. 10,000 gallons of oil were removed from the wastewater treatment plant there, and there's a light sheen of oil in the Columbia River that they've been fighting. They've been containing it by a 1,000-foot boom. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. K KUOW Seattle, if you don't like the way we educate kids here in Washington's public schools, you can always try a charter school. These are the publicly funded but privately run schools that were sold to voters as an alternative for students who struggle in traditional public schools. We have 8 such schools in our state. They're all in a legal limbo because the state Supreme Court forced some changes in our charter school law. As the schools wrap up their tumultuous first year, KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld looks at who enrolled in charter schools and how their experience compares to what voters were promised.
Everyone should know what their new station is. You start working, you have 8 minutes.
Okay, guys.
Walking through the halls of Excel Public Charter School, you'll see that most of the students are children of color. Founder Adele Safriwi says that's no coincidence. When he scouted sites for the school, he looked for a location in the south end of Kent, a diverse part of town and home to many low-income families.
Well, we really wanted to serve a population of students that was representative of the Kent community. We set out from the very get-go to serve students who were historically underserved.
Excel has a lot more black students than the surrounding school district. That's true for most of the state's charter schools. According to enrollment data the schools gave KUOW, some average 2 or 3 times as many black students compared to the districts in which they're based. That's significant because black students tend to lag behind white and Asian students academically. Safriwi attributes much of the black enrollment at his school to the fact that the charter is based at a largely African-American church.
Although we're not affiliated with the church in any way as a public school, I think the members of the congregation saw a lot of value in signing their kid up for, you know, a public school that happens to be in their building.
Poor students also tend to struggle in school, so the state's charters promise to target kids from low-income families. For the most part, they also met that goal.
That general pattern seems consistent with what is seen in a lot of other places.
Bob Bifulco is a professor of public administration at Syracuse University. He studied the demographics of charter schools in other states.
Charter schools are probably more likely to be serving low-income students and minority students, even in a lot of cases relative to the districts that they're operating in.
Bifulco says there are a lot of ways that charters end up with a particular student population. The schools often appeal to families who don't feel the nearby traditional public schools serve them well. Charters might also do as Excel did, locate in a neighborhood that's home to their target demographic and market to those families. But there are also areas in which Washington's first charter schools appear to be falling short. 2 major groups of students who often struggle in traditional public schools are kids who need special education services and English language learners, or ELL students. State law lists kids who need ELL and special ed services as particular focus areas for charters. But most of the state's charter schools enrolled fewer special education and ELL students than the district average. Bifulco says that's a trend he's seen nationwide.
You know, the charter schools are often set up for a specific mission. Serving certain high-needs special education students is just not part of their mission, and so, you know, they don't have a lot to offer those students. Whereas the public school districts, they have no choice but to take that on as part of their mission.
When it comes to ELL students, Bifulco says lower enrollment might be due to the difficulty of reaching out to immigrant families. Some charter leaders we spoke to said that was the case, or that immigrant families wanted their kids to go to school closer to home. In some states, charter schools have been shown to have used selective admissions processes to screen out students they deem harder to teach, or canceled families out if the students proved difficult or expensive for the school. That can help charters keep standardized test scores up and keep them in business. We didn't find evidence that's happening in Washington, but Bifulco says because school demographics can vary so dramatically, there's no easy way to compare the success rate of a charter school to a traditional public school. Such comparisons will be tempting for analysts when state test scores are released this summer. I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
You're listening to The Record here on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I want to give you a quick check of national news. A prosecutor has just announced today that no charges will be brought against the mother of a little boy who got into the gorilla exhibit at the Cincinnati Zoo. You remember that the boy climbed over the barrier and made his way through the bushes and fell down into the moat there, and the zoo shot the agitated gorilla concluding that the boy's life might be in danger. And that shooting set off a whole lot of criticism, with some people attacking the zoo for the gorilla's death, others blaming the mother for not watching her child more closely. Well, on that score, the Hamilton County prosecutor says that three-year-old, quote, just scampered off. He said the case didn't come close to warranting a charge of child endangerment. He defended the mother as an attentive parent, undeserving of all the criticism. He said the mother had three other kids with her at the zoo, turned away for a few seconds to attend to one of them when the boy took off. And finally, prosecutor Joe Dieters said, quote, if anyone doesn't believe a three-year-old can scamper off very quickly, they've never had kids. You're listening to KUOW, Seattle. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining me here on The Record. The city of Seattle is trying to get homeless people to come out from under I-5, but people are still there, living in the so-called jungle. KUOW's Kate Walters reports they live there for all kinds of reasons. For some, it's a last resort. For others, it's the place they've come to call home. For a few residents, it comes down to proximity, to the things they need.
It's dark near Kevin Boggs's tent. The sun is mostly blocked by the freeway that stretches above his bright orange shelter. Boggs has lived in the jungle for about 6 months. His heroin addiction drove him onto the streets, and after having his tent repeatedly ransacked, he moved to the jungle for the sense of community and security it offered.
I need people, you need teammates, you need a family, you need a community to survive in a hostile environment. You have to. You cannot do it alone, so this is my not alone.
But there was another reason Boggs moved. He goes to a methadone treatment program nearby, a program for people addicted to opiates.
When I first became homeless and first enrolled in the program, I lived in Lake City, which is North Seattle. There is one bus that runs almost all the way here, and it only takes about 45 minutes to get here, but it was a commitment to get up and come all the way here.
There are only 3 methadone clinics in Seattle, and they usually have long wait lists. The program Boggs got into is run by Evergreen Treatment Services. It's on Airport Way South, a stone's throw from where he now lives, in the jungle.
Methadone basically gives any of us that stay on it the stability to actually live normal lives, go and get jobs without rushing out to obtain heroin every day.
And since being on methadone, Boggs has started working again. He's a welder in Redmond. But here's the catch with treatments like this. These kinds of medications are highly regulated, especially methadone.
Generally get up, throw on my shoes, and stumble on down here. It's just straight down the hill from my tent and then a left turn.
And how often do you have to do that?
Monday through Saturday, and Sunday I get a take-home dose. So every single day.
This is what can make it so hard. Methadone isn't like an antibiotic. You can't get a prescription, fill it at the pharmacy, and take it home. To get his medication, Boggs physically has to show up at the clinic every day.
Kevin Boggs, my dose is 40. Yes, sir.
He gets a small white plastic cup with pink liquid in it. It kind of looks like mouthwash. Boggs says the taste is pretty nasty. He swallows it in front of a nurse and washes it down with some water. Boggs also has to go to counselling and submit to random drug tests at least once a month. It's all part of the deal when you're on methadone. It is possible to get to a point where you get to take multiple doses of the medication home with you, but that only happens for patients who are considered stable. And it's particularly tough for people like Boggs, who are homeless, to get to that stage.
When you don't know where you're going to be that night, or if you have to leave your tent with all of your possessions in it and risk having it taken or stolen or swept away, that becomes a huge stressor, which absolutely impacts people's ability to focus on the treatment.
Molly Carney is the executive director of Evergreen Treatment Services. She says about 40% of their clients are homeless, but she draws a clear line. The jungle and the tent encampments aren't there because of the clinic, she says. Though the clinic's homeless outreach team acknowledges Boggs is not the only patient who lives in the jungle. It's a symptom of a bigger problem. The number of heroin addicts who are also homeless is rising. And providing a place for homeless patients to stay just isn't part of the methadone clinic model. That was never built into the system that was created decades ago.
They really originated in dense urban cities where people lived and walked. And the idea was that it was a convenient place for people to easily come by multiple times per week. much as a Starbucks might be nowadays for Seattleites.
That's Caleb Bantagreen. He's an expert on opiate addiction and a member of the King County Heroin and Prescription Opiate Task Force. The issue, Bantagreen says, is that opiate addiction isn't concentrated in dense urban cores anymore. It's in neighborhoods, in suburbs, in rural areas. It's everywhere.
And all of a sudden, instead of talking about a 10-minute walk, you're talking about a one-hour drive, or in some instances, even 2 or 3 hour drives. And that's obviously untenable for anybody to have anything going on in their life other than just showing up at the clinic.
It's this disconnect between the prevalence of addiction and the availability of treatment that the King County Task Force wants to change. The goal is for people like Kevin Boggs to be able to access their medication without it taking over their lives. So how do you do that? One answer? More clinics like the one on Airport Way South. The task force also wants to get more doctors on board to prescribe buprenorphine, another addiction treatment medication that can be prescribed by a regular family doctor. But that means getting rid of the stigma attached to these treatments and lowering the barrier for both prescribers and patients, Bantagreen says.
It needs to be a normal thing that all primary care doctors do. Most primary care doctors prescribe opiates for pain. Most of them take care of treating depression with antidepressants. So it is addiction that we think is a fundamentally different medical condition. It isn't fundamentally different.
Kevin Boggs says wider access and lower barriers to treatment could make a huge difference for others like him.
You know, it's like my shield that I need. I'm not afraid to be without it, but I know what would happen.
For now, Boggs is focusing on getting back on his feet. A year from now, he's hoping he'll be further along in his treatment, and his bright orange tent will be a long-gone memory. In the jungle, I'm Kate Walters for KUOW.
So the city of Seattle has asked the Union Gospel Mission to work with the people living in the jungle, including helping them move out. Well, so far, the mission has helped about 40 people get into shelters, treatment, or housing, but there are hundreds of people living in the jungle, including Brandy Osborne.
I may not go anywhere. I may sit in my tent door and say, screw you. And thank you, folks. And that's, no, don't get me wrong, that's not just to defend the jungle. This is to defend homeless men, women, children, and animals everywhere. Somebody has to stand up for what they believe in. I don't think they can just keep pushing us all around the neighborhood, you know, and putting us on our little island where they want us so they can run us like robots.
Brandy Osborne lives in that homeless encampment under I-5, and she was talking last week at a KUOW community event to discuss just this issue. Brandy's comments about feeling pushed around probably do not surprise Jeff Lilly. Jeff Lilly is head of the Union Gospel Mission. He says most of the people he's talked to in the jungle do not want to leave.
They've found a place where they can get settled, and for them, it's a place where they've been able to continue the choices they're making. And I'm speaking about addiction and some of the drug use that's going on there. And we estimate, our team has estimated, that it's 90%+ of the individuals under there are wrestling with some type of addiction recently or currently. And we don't want to paint that with a broad brush in the sense of saying that everybody under there is you know, facing addiction, but it's a
culture. You just said 90%.
Yeah. So, well, then my point being there that it is a culture that has a high drug use. So their choice to say, hey, if we stay under here, then that may be a preferred alternative to the alternatives that aren't necessarily satisfactory. If it's a shelter or if it's a recovery program, which means I'm going to have to try to get out of my addiction. Those are things that they're not necessarily choosing at this point.
Meaning if I'm here living under this freeway, I can do these drugs and nobody's going to stop me, and that's what I want.
Yeah.
What do you say to somebody like that?
We have conversations about options and choices and hope for the future. Because they know they're trapped in a cycle that's destructive to their family, to their friends, to, you know, having a job and being able to get back on their feet. It's a compelling conversation. When you talk with them, they're afraid. They're afraid of what the city is going to do when the city moves them. Where do we go? That's an unknown. But they're also afraid living there. And they're fairly clear about that, that this is a situation that scares them, even just staying. So it's a real conversation about that. And as we have that conversation, oftentimes then they begin to stop and say, well, what could I do? What are the options? And that's where our team engages with them, and we begin to map out plans. But until there's a better alternative, and it's hard for them to imagine one, then that's exactly what we're doing, is trying to bring hope back into their life that there might be an option.
Well, and you are the Union Gospel Mission, Jeff. At what point does Jesus come into this picture?
We've been clear with the city that is not, we're not leading with a faith component of, you know, saying, hey, we're here to talk about Jesus with you. Quite frankly, what we're there to do is to be Jesus to them. It's to simply love on them, care for them, and listen to them. And we direct them towards the whole battery of services that we have and that the city has, other service providers, everything that's out there. So this isn't a situation where we're out there trying to proselytize or to get somebody to become a Christian. This is a situation where Christians are going out and doing what more Christians should be doing. And it's loving on those that are in great need and helping them and get to a better place.
What do you do when someone doesn't want to accept the help you're offering?
Well, this is the role for us, is to just continue to reach out to them and offer help, and then we'll be there even afterwards to continue to walk with people. And that's something, the mission's 84 years old, doing just this, reaching out to individuals who've found themselves in a hard spot and doing everything we can to help them and get to a better place.
The city has said that people are not going to be cleared out of the jungle unless they've been offered meaningful help and still won't move. So what to you is meaningful help?
Yeah, that seems to be the million-dollar word right there. You know, in this situation, I think we're looking at some individuals who've chosen to kind of go into one of the back corners of our city, and many of them are involved in are wrestling with a drug addiction. So in that case, what is meaningful to them? What is going to be that issue that they say yes to? You know, just offering a basic shelter bed isn't going to satisfy them. They're not going to necessarily move towards that. But at this point, what we feel like is we're not sure they're going to move towards anything than where they are right now.
Jeff Lilly with the Union Gospel Mission, what have you learned over these past couple of weeks about the people in the jungle and what they want and what they need?
Oh, I think that they're just like us. They're not these unusual, strange people. They're people that are wrestling with some difficult challenges in their life, and they need help. It's that type of thing where I think for all of us, we tend to move away from difficult situations. And when somebody's in a difficult situation, we tend to move away from that person. And this has just convinced me all the more that we need to move towards those who are struggling, move towards those that are in hard places, and actually be, you know, moving towards those difficult situations in other people's lives. I know that when I'm in a tough time, I'm comforted most by those friends who move towards me during that time. Oftentimes for all of us, it's awkward when somebody's in a hard place. If we have somebody who dies and, you know, a neighbor of ours, their husband just recently died, and you feel awkward at first, like, what do I do? What do I say? And unfortunately, I think for many people who are facing homelessness, that's what we do as a community. And I believe that one of the best things we can do is actually move towards them, come around them, love on them, care for them, listen to their stories, and see if we can be part of a way to make their life better.
Jeff Lilly, head of the Union Gospel Mission. He told me that the number of people still living in the jungle has gone down a lot over the past couple of weeks, but that most of the people leaving are not going into services. They're just pitching their tents in a different spot. Lilly says that Union Gospel Mission is using legal teams and housing programs and treatment services to try to get people into long-term housing. We have been covering this issue, meeting the people who live in the jungle, meeting people who want to help, meeting people whose job it is to administer this situation in the jungle, also known as the I-5 East Duwamish Greenbelt. That's what some city officials would rather we call that homeless encampment. You will find our coverage of these issues on the web at KUOW.org. In fact, we put together really a beautiful photo essay from the jungle. You can find that. We'll tweet it out to you right now. We're live tweeting the show. We'll send that out right now at KUOW. And one Seattle news update here. We've been covering that student sit-in at Seattle University, the group of students at the university's Humanities College, Matteo Ricci. That group has occupied Casey Hall for more than 20 days, protesting what they call a hostile and unsafe learning environment for minorities at the college. Well, apparently the student sit-in is over. The students, who they've been complaining that the school is racially clueless, a faculty too white, a curriculum focused on dead white male authors, a hostile reaction to students who are in the minority or think outside the mainstream. So last week, the university put the dean of that humanities college on administrative leave. And today, the student group called that move a monumental success. And they say because of the progress that's been made on putting together a curriculum review committee, they've decided to end their sit-in. Finally, they say that sit-in is not the end of the movement. They're going to keep pushing for change in the college at Seattle University. Back in a moment now on the record, including the question, do we have to grow around here? Do we have to keep growing? Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. Marshawn Lynch would like you to know he is done. The Seahawks star is finished playing football, okay? What more do you need? He tweeted the picture of his cleats hanging from a telephone wire. He filed his retirement paperwork with the NFL. The Seahawks gave him an official farewell. And yet, Marshawn has always been so elusive, so hard to read, that there's been a persistent rumor or hope or prophecy that Marshawn might be a Seahawk again. But then came his appearance last night on CBS's 60 Minutes.
No, I'm done. I'm done. I enjoyed my time playing. Now it's time to watch my cousins do their thing.
You good never playing another down?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed my time.
But are you sure, Marshawn? I mean, we noticed you didn't say pinky promise. Were your fingers crossed behind your back? Are you positive you're done with the Seahawks?
I'm retired. Is that good enough? Which camera you want me to look into?
This right one, me.
I'm done. I'm not playing football anymore.
There you have it. He said it to a camera. Marshawn Lynch says he'll never be a Seahawk again, guaranteed. We at the KOW's The Record look forward to him suiting up and returning to the Seahawks next season. He can't quit us. It's 12:54. Glad to have you tuned in. John Talton's with us now. Hiya, John.
Hi, Bill.
Seattle Times economics columnist. We've been having a little debate here. Can we continue it? What's that?
I'm done.
You know, I'm not done with you yet. I want this explained. For the third year in a row, John, Seattle's one of America's five fastest growing cities by population.
Percentage. You've heard?
Percentage population, yeah. And this is something we talk about a lot here. Grow, grow, grow. We're growing. SeaTac Airport has got to expand. We've got to have more light rail. We've got to get dense. We've got to build upward. My question for you is, who says? Who said, why can we not just stop growing if we want to? We're good.
Well, big question, short time. One thing is it's a free country. People can come where they want. And the second thing is that nobody's figured out an alternative to either economic growth or economic stagnation. And who gets hurt or the worst by economic stagnation? The people at the bottom of the ladder.
But why is there nothing in between growth and stagnation? Why couldn't we just be right where we want to be?
I would love to freeze Seattle at the point in time where everybody thinks it was the best. But Seattle whiners whine all the time. It's like they whine if it's 50 degrees and then they whine when it's over 75. And so there was never a time when Seattleites weren't whining. Other cities would kill for what we have.
I know, but that's for them to envy. Like, why can't we say, go ahead and envy us, but we're going to, like, no more companies over 500 employees or a cap on growth or whatever. Why couldn't we, if we wanted to, weird as it sounds, just stop right where we are?
Well, I mean, we can continue to enact laws. We can raise taxes. We can do a host of things to make it so expensive here to drive business out. But that will not ultimately help us. People want to come here. I mean, when we didn't build our subway in 1970, we said, well, if we build it, Seattle's going to grow. Well, it grew anyway, and we sure wish we had that subway now. Growth, economic growth, means that you can have quality growth or you can have bad growth. There are cities like Houston and Phoenix that are growing much more than Seattle, population-wise. But say in the case of Phoenix, fifth or sixth largest city in the country, the economy is abysmal. The wages are low, but there's a lot of land, and people continue to move there. And far more people in the aggregate than move here. We're just growing fast for Seattle. What you want to grow is you want to grow incomes for everybody. You want to grow college graduates, high school completion. You want to grow quality of life.
But maybe quality of life is the not growing. Why couldn't we just keep wages where they are and college graduates where they are? Why is it either climb, 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 or you mentioned, you know, stagnation? You make it sound so scary. If we stop growing, we plunge or something. How does that work?
Well, it's the way the world economy works with a very competitive situation. You can look at a city like Minneapolis, and it's okay, almost sui generis, where it hasn't grown very much. It has very high quality of life and a good economy. I can't think of another city in America that is like that.
Okay, why can't we be like Minneapolis?
Well, we've got to import a lot of Norwegians and a lot of people who are just born here and not have very many technology companies and have that passive-aggressive Nordic thing. I mean, we used to have that a lot in places like Ballard. But Seattle is one of the most desirable places in the world. So the question for us is whether we're going to have high quality growth and then provide the infrastructure for it, or whether we're going to muddle along with the great Seattle process and have just the costs of growth.
So what do you see as the key to, let's assume that we got to grow? And I'm not going to win this argument, but then what do you think is the key? You said infrastructure. Help us figure out what's good growth then.
Well, I mean, we need the dense employment centers that we have. That's good because you want to have dense employment centers so you don't have people driving everywhere increasing climate change. What we need to do is have the rail transit built quickly to bring people from affordable areas in the metro area into these dense employment centers. Then the city of Seattle needs to figure out a way to break the NIMBY-Trotsky alliance and build more high-quality density. Midtown Manhattan used to be pastures, but it's not anymore.
Isn't that relentless? In other words, so we grow bigger, and then a few years from now, you and I are saying, we got to grow even bigger.
Well,
it never ends.
You and I don't get to say it. If we did, we wouldn't need this radio and newspaper gig. These are national and global forces far larger than us. Seattle will hit a ceiling of sorts. But
a happy ceiling, you think? It can end. This ends well?
Part of it is our choice.
Uh-huh.
Part of it is the volcano and the earthquake's choice.
Right. There's that ceiling.
There's that, and then there's just poor public policy.
Okay. So you got time for one more word of advice to the decision makers listening to you.
Well, they need to understand that we are going to grow and that we're blessed to be at the headwaters of the technology economy with very well-paying jobs and plugged into the Pacific Rim. We need to leverage all of that to make life better for as many people as possible. And build that rail transit fast.
Build. He said it again. That's Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. John, good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Listening to The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.